Now, last week we took a look at the account of Jesus walking on the water, and we began to look at this miracle. We've divided the miracles and the works of Jesus into three categories. One of them is the power of Christ. Obviously, the miracles demonstrate the power of Jesus Christ. Secondly, there's another group of miracles that demonstrate true religion. There are miracles that are designed to show people the difference between their false religion of the time and true religion that Jesus is teaching, religion of the heart. Then there's a third category of miracles that are designed to test and build faith. To test it, to see where it's weak, and then to build it up and fortify it. This miracle goes in both categories 1 and 3. Last week we talked about the power of Christ. This week we're going to talk about the fact that this is designed to test and to build the disciples' faith and your faith and mine. Jesus wanted to demonstrate the areas where the disciples' faith was ineffective and lacking and inadequate, and then to strengthen it at the same time in those areas. So let's first look at the testing. And we'll look at the disciples' faltering faith. Both Matthew and Mark make the same point, but they do it in different ways. They highlight the failure of the disciples' faith and the fact that it was faltering. But Matthew shows us the faltering faith of the disciples by giving us the example of Peter's failure. Mark gives us, he shows us the faltering faith of the disciples by describing the whole group and how they all failed. But in both Gospels, we find a serious failure. Let's read from Mark 6, verse 45. It says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after leaving them, he went up to a mountainside to pray. And when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on the land. Jesus was. So he saw the disciples straining at the oars, because the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he went out. Now stop there. It's the fourth watch of the night. Fourth watch of the night is between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. In verse 23, we see that they left in the evening. So they're rowing somewhere between 7 and 12 hours for a 2-mile trip across the tip of the lake. And the reason I point that out is just to show you the level of their obedience here is astonishing. This is some commitment to obey what Jesus told them to do. He said, go across. Now, I've rowed a boat before for several hours at a time, and that was I've never rowed for 10 hours, especially not getting anywhere. It's amazing. You'd expect that if the wind were that fierce, they would row against it for 2, 3, 4 hours and then give up and go back. They won't do it. This is just tenacious obedience. Jesus told them to take that boat across the lake, and they are going to take that boat across that lake if it kills them. And it's a good lesson for us, because we need to realize that just because you're obeying the Lord doesn't mean everything's going to go smoothly for you. It doesn't mean that you're exempt from great difficulty. Extreme difficulty, sometimes it can be an indication that it's unwise to take a certain path. But if you already know for sure that God wants you on a specific path, then don't ever let hardship and difficulty deter you from that. And don't interpret that as God sending some kind of a message that you're on the wrong path. Because very often, the path that God calls you to take is a very difficult one. So their obedience is exemplary. It's wonderful. It's amazing. They're very committed. And so at this point, you might be wondering, well, why is this section entitled Faltering Faith in the outline then? I mean, where's the failure in their faith? It doesn't seem like a failure. Disciples seem like heroes in this story, especially Peter. I mean, they're committed to radical obedience. Peter's walking on water. It seems like this is the disciple at their best. We rarely see them in this form. And yet Mark presents it as a failure and says their hearts were hard. Matthew presents it as a failure in Peter's part and he's rebuked. And you think, well, if they have such radical, persistent, tenacious obedience, what's wrong? What do they do wrong? What more does God want? What is it that they do that's so bad? Some people say, well, it was because they were afraid and they had the fear, but that's not the case. As I mentioned, they're not rebuked for their fear. So what's the failure? And they're not afraid of the storm either, by the way, and we'll get to that. Well, Mark tells us what the failure is in Mark 6, 51, verse 51. See what it says there? They were completely amazed. That was their failure. They were completely amazed. That's what they did wrong. The problem wasn't that they were afraid. The problem was that they were completely amazed. It was the imperfect tense of the verb, meaning that they were continuously being astonished. Even after it was all over, so the storm is still, Jesus is in the boat, everything's done, still they were amazed. They didn't know what to make of it. They didn't know how to interpret this. You can imagine them being startled initially, but after it was all over, and they knew it was Jesus, still, they didn't know what to make of this. You say, why didn't they know what to make of it? How come they didn't know how to interpret this? Well, it's because verse 52 tells us why. The reason they didn't know what to make of it, and the reason they were rocked off their senses is because of verse 52, for they had not understood about the loaves. That was the problem. They didn't understand about the loaves. Remember I told you that miracle of the loaves and fishes was so important. They didn't understand that Jesus is capable of doing anything. They did not expect Jesus to behave like deity, and when he did, they were astonished and didn't know what to make of it, didn't know how to interpret it. You say, well, why didn't they just say, well, I know how to interpret this. Jesus is God, so he can walk on water. Why didn't they just figure that? Mark tells us why they didn't figure that. And that's why they're rebuked here. Jesus rebukes them, even while in the midst of unbelievable obedience, because obedience is not enough. The Lord also requires understanding, especially about the loaves, the miracle of the loaves. Now, I want you to think about that, because if the disciples demonstrate this level of amazing display of obedience and still are rebuked just because they didn't understand about the loaves, that tells us something about how important it is to God that we understand the miracle of the loaves, right? It's very important to God that you understand about the loaves. After the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus expected his followers to understand exactly who he was. That he was God in human flesh, he was capable of creation, he was capable of unlimited power. And he expected them to know that. It's not enough that you obey God's commands. You must also know Christ for who he really is. Without an accurate understanding of the nature of God, obedience is worthless. God wants you to know him. That's what he wants of you. So ask yourself, do you understand about the loaves? Do you expect God to behave like deity? Do you assume that he will provide? Or do you worry? Do you have full confidence that he will always do what's best? Or are you anxious all of the time? Do you trust him? It all depends on if you understand about the loaves. It all depends on if you understand his character. The thing that we read in the Psalm, that he's both perfectly good and perfectly powerful. Now, they didn't understand about the loaves. Now you say, well, wait a minute. They knew about the loaves, right? I mean, did they miss it? Oh, yeah, they understood it. They were the ones that had to pass out 5 to 10 tons of food to thousands of people. This miracle ended up being a lot of work for the disciples. They noticed it. They knew exactly what happened. But they didn't understand it. They just couldn't understand. You say, well, wait a minute. Is it right to rebuke them for that? Is it their fault? If you can't understand something, is it your fault? I mean, is it their fault that they couldn't understand this? And the answer is yes. They couldn't understand it, didn't know what to make of it, couldn't interpret it, and it's their fault. And Mark tells us why. Verse 52, they didn't understand because their hearts were hardened. Sometimes people don't understand just because something's not clear. It's confusing to them, and so they can't understand it. But not always. Many times, they don't understand because of a hard heart. Something is clear enough, it's just hard-heartedness. Every time this word hardened, the word translated hardened here, is used in the Bible, it's always associated with lack of understanding. It refers to a stubborn unwillingness to accept something that God has revealed. A hardening of yourself against the truth. See, while Jesus was doing the miracle of the loaves, while he kept breaking them apart and passing them around, the disciples made their hearts such that the truth about the implications about Christ couldn't penetrate. They saw it happen. It couldn't be denied. It had obvious implications about who Christ was, but they just didn't want to face up to those implications, and so they held them off at arm's length. That's what it means to harden your heart against the truth. It's an issue of the will. Hardening your heart against a specific truth means that you're not willing to let that truth penetrate your heart and make demands on your life. And the result ends up being an inability to understand that truth eventually. You can't understand it because you won't allow yourself to accept it. So God removes your ability to understand it. Understanding is not just a function of the intellect. Sometimes a person can have a brilliant mind and can understand all kinds of complex, complicated things, and yet certain principles he can't get them because of a hard heart. He won't accept them. Intellect is needed. Intellect is important. You should try and advance your intellect. I mean, you should try and be smart. We don't want to be dumb. But that's not enough. Intellect is not enough. Mike Rosen is a talk show host who used to argue passionately against abortion people would call, he's not a believer, but people would call up and he'd use logic and just dismantle people who would call and were pro-abortion. And he understood all those arguments. And then he changed. And now he's pro-abortion. And he thinks it's okay now. And some caller called him once and asked him why he changed. And he says it's because his daughter got old enough and got into a position where she needed an abortion or might need an abortion. And so he changed his mind based on what he wanted to believe. Now, he's proved in the past that he has the intellectual ability to understand the arguments that prove that abortion is wrong. And yet now he can't understand those because he's not willing to. Understanding is always a function of the heart. Turn to Matthew 13. I just want to show you a couple of passages that highlight this so you understand that it's not just a function of the intellect. In Matthew 13, Jesus tells a parable about a farmer broadcasting seed. The seed is the gospel. The soils represent the different kinds of hearts. And there are four different kinds of human hearts. Take a look at verse 3. The farmer went out, sowed the seed. He was scattering the seed. Some of the seed fell on the path. That's one kind of heart. And the birds came and ate it up. This is a hard soil. It represents the hard heart, and it won't let the gospel penetrate. Now, look down to verse 18. It says, Jesus interpreting his own parable. He says, listen to what the parable of the sower means. When anyone hears the message about the kingdom and doesn't understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart, and the seed, and that's the seed sown on the path. If you don't understand it, that's because your heart is like a path that people have been walking on out in a field. It's just rock hard. It's like concrete almost, and the seed won't penetrate. The gospel can't get in there. The person that doesn't understand the gospel, sometimes it's because it wasn't explained to them adequately. Sometimes that's the case. But sometimes it's explained just fine, and they can't understand it because they won't accept it. Their heart is like hard soil. Can't understand because they're not willing to accept. Jesus wanted to weed people like that out of his group of followers. When he would collect these masses of followers, he wanted those kind of people to get away and to leave. And so he would always do things he would speak in, that's the reason he spoke in kind of cryptic, hard to understand sayings and parables. It's because those kind of people would get sick of that and leave eventually. Because they didn't have enough interest to find out what the parable meant. Verse 13, that's what he says. This is why I speak in parables. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. In them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah. You will be ever hearing, but never understanding. You'll be ever seeing, but never perceiving. For this people, the heart has become calloused. So that's why I speak in parables. Your hearts are hard, you're not willing to accept the truth, and I want to expose that, and so I'm going to speak in a way that only the open-hearted, interested people will understand. Because only they will have the energy to pursue it enough to learn what it means. Flip over to chapter 16 of Matthew. This is much later. Jesus again rebukes the disciples for not understanding about the loaves. Verse 8. Aware of their discussion, he says something about yeast. They misinterpret. They say, oh, he's mad because we forgot the lunch. They don't understand anything. And aware of their discussion, Jesus says, you of little faith. Why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? Do you still not understand? Now look at the construction there. Compare verse 8 to verse 9. Inability to understand equals little faith, right? Inability to understand equals little faith. The ability to understand is connected to your faith. If you're unwilling to believe, then you're not going to be able to understand. That's really what faith is, a willingness to understand, a willingness to accept the truth. In our scientific culture, we naively believe that what we believe is determined solely by the evidence. The way it should be, but that's not the way it is. We all have biases. That's why we come to different conclusions with the same evidence. We interpret evidence through the filter of our biases. And usually we assume that if we don't understand something, it's not our fault. But sometimes it is. You read something in the Bible, you can't understand it, and then we conclude, well, you know, the problem is the Bible. Not clear enough. It's too hard to understand. It's unclear, and it's not my fault that I can't understand it. We need to consider the possibility that the lack of understanding might be a symptom of a hardness in our heart against or an unwillingness to accept a certain truth. You can understand other passages in the Bible because you're more than willing to accept those truths. But this one truth that's hard for you to accept, you can't understand because you won't accept. That happens. Some people have nothing but constant questions, and constant confusion about everything in the Bible. And when that happens, it may very well be that a person like that doesn't have true saving faith, and so they never understand because the true answers they won't accept, and all the other answers don't make sense. It's important that you allow the truth to penetrate your heart, even when it hurts, especially when it hurts. Sometimes you hear a truth, and accepting that truth might mean changing something that you've believed for a long time. That's hard to do. Sometimes accepting a truth might mean making a huge change in your life that you don't want to make. Sometimes it might mean altering the way that you've always thought about God. Sometimes it might point to the sin in your life that you don't really want to admit is a sin. Sometimes the truth cuts, it hurts, and sometimes you can just find yourself flayed by the Word of God. Sometimes you can sit through a sermon and find yourself ground up. Sorry. I mean, that happens to me. I get to studying this stuff, and it convicts my heart. I mean, there are some things that I come across, and I'm studying it, and I start pursuing it, and I start saying, I'm not so sure I want to accept that, if that's where this is going. And I maybe don't like the way where something is leading, and the temptation for me is just to stop investigating that and just move on to something else. That is very dangerous when that happens. Because if you sit there and you harden your heart against it when you're studying God's Word or when you're listening to the sermon and there's something that's starting to intrude on your life and you say, I think I'll not think about that. You do that and you refuse to accept that principle, you can damage your heart. You can do irreversible damage, because once you resist it, you can get so that you can't understand it at all, that you can't accept it. And over time, your heart can get so hard, it becomes like Pharaoh, where God just allows it to stay hard. They say the same sun that melts the wax hardens the clay. That's a great saying. God's Word is like sun, and you got to make sure your heart is not like clay, but it's like wax, and it gets softened and not hardened. Because once you harden your heart against the truth one time, it's so much easier to do it the next time. And pretty soon you're only accepting things that are easy for you to accept from God. And this can happen to godly people. That's what I want you to understand. This can happen to tenaciously obedient, godly people like you. And we see that here with the disciples who are so committed to obeying Christ and yet their hearts are hard. So that's Matthew's account. That's the disciples' failure. Now let me show you another failure. Let's look over at Peter's failure. I'm sorry, that was Mark's account. Now let's look over at Matthew 14 and see Peter's failure. What Peter did was amazing. He walks on water. He walked on water. He's the only human being, other than God himself, to ever walk on water. Moses didn't do that. Elijah didn't do that. Nobody's ever done that. Now, there are a lot of people who claim to have a lot of miraculous power and ability and everything. They do amazing tricks, but they don't walk on water. They might walk on coals or something, but not water. Peter walked on water. It wasn't because of his own ability. It was because of his faith. I mean, he couldn't do that on his own, obviously. He grew up around the water. He's a professional fisherman. He'd been on the Sea of Galilee all his life, and never once had he walked on it. He could barely float in it. I mean, he had trouble with that. He's unable to do it on his own, but he was able to do it here because of his faith. And we know that because when he sank, Jesus said, you have little faith. He had little faith, that's why he sank. So when he wasn't sinking, it was because of his strong faith. So Peter had strong faith. Peter had remarkable faith. Enough faith to get out of the boat in a storm in the middle of the night and walk across water. That's faith. So why is he rebuked? What did he do wrong? Some people say, well, it was presumption. That was his sin. He was presumptuous in getting out of the boat. But I don't think that's it. I don't see presumption here. If Peter were being presumptuous, he wouldn't have asked Jesus. He wouldn't have said, command me to come on the water. He would have just jumped out of the boat on his own. That's what presumption does. Presumption is when you assume God is going to do something that he hasn't promised to do. That's presumption. For example, somebody buys something that they can't afford and they say, I'm trusting God to provide these payments, you know, that I have to make now. That's presumption. But that's not what Peter's doing here. Verse 28, he says, Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water. The word tell there literally is command. Peter does not say, Lord, if it's you, enable me to walk on water. He doesn't say that. He says, if it's you, command me to come to you. The fact that it's water is actually, I think, incidental. The only reason the water is involved is because that's what's in between Jesus and Peter. And Peter doesn't want anything in between him and Jesus. Peter just wants to be with Jesus. And anytime Peter is in a boat and Jesus is outside of the boat, Peter becomes aware of it. Peter exits the boat. Right? And he doesn't ask for a promise. He doesn't say, Lord, promise me I won't sink. He asks for what? A command. Command me to come to you. I think this is a great illustration of what presumption is not. Exactly what we're supposed to do is ask God for a command. Presumption just informs God. God, I'm doing this. I'm jumping out of the boat. So hold me up. Faith says, Lord, command me. And I'll wait for your command. The true heart of faith desires a command from God. The person with true faith longs to do God's will, wants to know what God wants, and desires to know what God commands. Presumption doesn't seek a command from God. Presumption gives a command to God. Tells God what to do. That's the difference. You ever wonder if you're demonstrating faith or operating on presumption? Just ask, am I commanding God or is God commanding me? That's the difference. Is this whole thing my will and I expect God to comply? Or is it God's revealed will and I'm trying to comply? Some people get a great idea. They say, oh, you know, we're stepping out on faith. And they get themselves into a huge mess. And God is up in heaven saying, I never required that of you. Why did you do that? Presumption just hops out of the boat. Presumption, if Peter were presumptuous, he'd say, watch this, guys, I'm walking on water. He'd hop out of the boat. Next thing you know, he's at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee, meditating on Jonah's story, naming and claiming a great fish or something. No, I don't think this is presumptuous. And another reason why I don't think Peter did anything wrong here is because Jesus goes along with it. Verse 29, come, he said. And then Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and he came to Jesus. If Peter were doing something wrong, Jesus wouldn't encourage it. What Peter did, I think, is a very good thing, and he's to be commended. He had remarkable faith. To be willing to step out of a boat in a storm, walk across water, is great faith. That's outstanding. Great job Peter did here. Nevertheless, however, Peter is rebuked by Jesus for his little faith. The fact that Peter walked on water is great. He's to be commended for his faith there. But the fact that he trusted to that level is not enough. Jesus required more. The fact that the disciples had tremendous obedience isn't the point. Jesus required more. See, man looks on the outward appearance and God looks on the heart. To us, it seems like this is an example of greatness, not failure. But Jesus said in Luke 12:48, that from those people that much is given, much is required. And only the Lord knows how much a person has been given. The disciples had been given adequate revelation of whom Christ was, and they're still bewildered, and so they're rebuked. And Peter had been given great faith, enough faith to walk all the way over to Jesus on water and to stay up on the water, and yet he doubted and sank, and so he's rebuked. He shouldn't have sunk. You say, wow, how much faith is required? Simple. As much as the Lord requires of you. As much as the Lord has enabled you to have. Here's an example of a person who has more faith than anyone else around. I don't see anybody else getting out of that boat. And yet he's still rebuked. Did you know that you can have greater, stronger faith than anyone in this church, anyone in this county, and still, perhaps it's not enough? Depending on what the Lord is requiring specifically of you. Maybe the Lord is requiring more of you than you realize. That's why Paul said, we don't dare classify ourselves or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves. When they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they're not wise. We're not the standard. God requires different things from different people. Now let's look at Peter's failure here. What caused him to sink? He has enough faith to walk all the way over there in the water to Jesus. What made him sink? Verse 30. When he saw the wind, and by the way, he walked some distance. Jesus was far enough away that they didn't recognize him until they heard his voice. So he's some distance away. And Peter was right by Jesus when he sank, so he walked some distance. What made him sink? Verse 30. This is kind of funny, what made him sink. You're going to laugh when you see this. Verse 30. When he saw the wind. He saw the wind and was afraid and began to sink. The wind? If you're out in the middle of the sea, standing on the water, you've got a problem, but your problem is not wind. It's gravity, right? It's water. Why is he afraid of the wind? And some people might see that and say, wait, you mean to say he didn't see that it was windy before? He's been rowing for 10 hours and hasn't gotten anywhere and he didn't notice it's windy out? Now, of course he knew it was windy. He was aware of the wind. The difference is in what captured his attention. From the moment Peter realized that this was Jesus, he forgot about the wind. He forgot about the boat. He wasn't aware of the water, the storm. He was aware of one thing, and that is Christ. He wanted to be by Jesus. And while his attention was focused on Christ, he did fine. When his attention was diverted to the storm, he doubted. And that's the point. Think about that. Jesus in the middle of the lake. He's walking on water. He just enabled Peter to walk on water. It's obvious Jesus has the power to do all that. It's obvious that Jesus has the power to make Peter stay up on the water. Divine power is being displayed in an astonishing way, and Peter thinks the wind is the problem? You say, is it really that much easier to walk on flat, calm, placid water than wavy water? No, that's not the point. The point is the distraction that the wind was. The storminess and the wind and the waves are a distraction, and they capture your attention away from Christ. In his heart, Peter was fully convinced that Jesus is more powerful than the wind and than gravity. But he allowed what he knew in his heart to be eclipsed by what he saw right in front of his face. The storm. He allowed what he knew in his heart to be eclipsed by what he saw with his eyes. When his eyes were on Jesus, his faith was strong, but when all of a sudden he turned his attention to the big 8-foot wave crashing toward him, suddenly he's wondering if Jesus' power is going to hold up, if this miracle is going to hold up through this wave. And he's not thinking about the power of Christ anymore, he's thinking about the wave. By the way, this is just incidentally, some people teach that the water was smooth in front of Jesus when he walked on water. It was just all placid right around where he was. I don't know why people say that, but the Bible doesn't say that. And this passage, I think, just proves that because Peter is right there by Jesus and he's getting hammered by the wind and everything. So this is a violent thing. This is a real thing. This is not some kind of a dream world. This is real water. They're getting soaked. The wind is blowing. The waves are crashing. Jesus is standing on it. And so is Peter until he sinks. So Jesus rebuked him. And he said his faith was little. And he asks him, why did you doubt? The word doubt there literally means to be divided in two. Divided in two. Peter's really learning a hard lesson here, an important lesson. He has great confidence in the Lord, and that's great, but it's not good enough. He has to learn that Christ not only calls us to have confidence in Him, but to focus our undivided attention on Him. Because the moment you allow your attention to be divided, the moment you allow your attention to be split, and to be half on Christ and half on something else, you look to the right or to the left, no matter how amazing, no matter how strong your faith is, I promise you, you will fail. You will falter. Your faith will crumble. You'll sink. Even if you have enough faith to walk on water, you get distracted from Christ, your faith is going to choke. Incredibly important lesson for us. When your attention is focused on Christ, you will walk in the Spirit. Automatically, you will tend to walk in the Spirit. When you get distracted with earthly things, you're going to sink spiritually. It happens every time. Your faith is, you know, while you're at church, your faith is unshakable. It's strong. You're focused on Christ. But if the other 6 days you allow your attention to be diverted to all kinds of worldly things and earthly things, temporal things, there's absolutely no way your faith is going to hold up through that. No way. You're going to sink. The waves are going to start to look too big, and the Lord is going to be too far off to matter, and you're going to sink. The more time you spend each day thinking about things from an earthly, temporal perspective, the more you will experience defeat spiritually. I'm not talking about just thinking about sinful things. I'm talking about just thinking about temporal things, looking at the world through the eyes of the type of person who's an unbeliever would look through them, as if this world were all there were. You think like that for very long, you're going to sink. There are people who struggle and struggle and struggle and struggle spiritually, and they're baffled as to why. They do all the Christian things that you're supposed to do, and they still struggle. Nothing seems to help. And the reason for that very often is in between all their Christian things they're doing, their thought life is on earthly, temporal, natural, physical things. They're not taking heaven into consideration. Well, that was Peter's problem. He got distracted, he sank, and he was rebuked. And that's what Jesus' test revealed. Revealed the weakness in the disciples' faith and in Peter's faith. To us, it seems like they're doing great. Jesus reveals the truth with his test. So there the 11 disciples sit in the boat with their hearts crusted over by an unwillingness to accept the truth about Jesus that was revealed in the miracle of the loaves that day. And there Peter is, plunging down into the water now because of his distracted, weak faith. Now, let's just wrap up by watching Jesus take that faltering, weak faith and strengthening it. He fortifies their faith here. Now, I want you to watch how Jesus sets this all up. This is great. Verse 48. Now, about the fourth watch of the night, he went out to them, walking on the lake, and he was about to pass by them. And I want to focus your attention on that phrase, he's about to pass by them. At first, it seems like a difficulty, but when you understand what it means and study that phrase, it opens up the meaning of this passage. You can see what Jesus is doing. It's not like this is a race. You know, it's not Jesus saying, okay, last one of the shore is a rotten egg, and he's running out ahead of him. It kind of sounds like that. It kind of sounds like he's just strolling across the lake and he passes by. But the key to understanding this is the word pass. Understanding the word pass. The Greek word translated pass. We hear that word and we think in terms of passing like on the highway. You're behind someone and you get going faster than them and you get up ahead of them. Right? That's not really the flavor of this word. One example of how the word is commonly used is in Matthew 8:28. You don't have to turn there. I'll just read it to you. It's the story of the two demonized guys in Gadara. And it says they were so violent that no one could pass that way. Same word. See, what it means is to pass in the sense of entering into the vicinity of someone. Literally, it says he was desiring to pass them by. Jesus was desiring to pass into their vicinity. The point is, you could just say it this way. He wanted to make sure that he crossed their view. He wanted to get into their view. It's not that he was trying to get ahead of them. He was just taking pains to make sure they saw him from just the right distance. They had to be far enough to where they couldn't recognize who he was, but close enough to where they could hear his voice and then recognize. He didn't want them to be able to make out that it was Jesus, but he did want them to be able to make out that it was someone walking on water. It had to be just the right distance. This is the middle of the night. It's Passover, so there's a full moon. It's not necessarily cloudy just because it's windy, and so you might be some distance. One thing you learn when you study the miracles and the works of Jesus is that the Lord Jesus Christ orchestrated the events of his life. Things just didn't happen to him. Miracles of Jesus were not just reactions on the fly to things that happened to him. They're Jesus going out of his way to set up an event, exactly how he wants it set up, in order to teach something. Remember when we studied the very beginning of this series, we talked about the fact that Jesus taught through his miracles. His miracles were teachings just as much as his sermons were. Jesus is setting up the angles and the distances and everything else and the timing just right to set up this whole encounter so that they won't know it's him, but they will as soon as he speaks. And because of the way this is stated, I want to throw something else in. I think there's another reason about this passing by thing. The whole account presents the appearance of Jesus on this lake as a theophany, an appearance of God. It's used, the appearance of God type language that's often used in that day is used in this passage. A theophany is a manifestation of the transcendent Lord who appears to somebody in an amazing way. This word pass, it's the same word used in the Greek Old Testament in Exodus 33 when God passed in front of Moses on Mount Sinai. When Yahweh passed in front of Elijah in 1 Kings 19. Same word in the Greek. This phrase is language borrowed from the Old Testament to describe an appearance of God. It's designed to remind the reader, I think, of Job 9 in verse 8. It says, he alone treads on the waves of the sea. When he passes me, I cannot see him. And when he goes by, I cannot perceive him. Talking about the greatness of God. Look at verse 48. He decided to pass in front of them. He decided to pass in their view. Verse 49, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought it was a ghost. And they cried out because they all saw and were terrified. Now, in different contexts, the disciples are rebuked for their fear, but not here. However, it is worth noting what they're afraid of. As I told you before, they're not afraid of the storm. This isn't like that massive cataclysmic storm the last time they're on the Sea of Galilee when they were scared that they were going to die, that they're going to drown, and Jesus is sleeping in the back of the boat and all that. they never show any fear of the storm here. It's probably just a normal storm, just like the storms that they were used to all the time on that lake, and they could handle that just fine. They had professional fishermen with them, and they were just fine. They weren't afraid of the storm. There's no indication they were afraid at all until Jesus showed up. They were not afraid of the storm. They were afraid of Jesus. They didn't know it was Him. But they knew it was someone. I mean, this isn't just some obscure little shadow out there in the distance that it's got them a little nervous. People see a strange shadow at night or at sea. You know, when they're out at sea, if you see something, you don't know what to make of it. You might blow it off, or you might think it's some kind of a sea monster, maybe. But not, you don't just assume it's somebody walking, right? I mean, people who think they see things all the time, people say they see Bigfoot in the woods, and they see Loch Ness at sea, but they don't see Bigfoot at sea. You don't just assume it's a person walking unless you really can see, yeah, that's a person walking. Especially if you got 12 guys there. This was so real. There is absolutely no question there somebody was approaching the boat walking on the water. Now to add to that, the people believed that the seas were the domain of evil spirits and storms were caused by those evil spirits. Now that's kind of freaky if you think about the last time they were on this lake, because the last time they came this way, remember what they ran into? Over 2,000 violent, hostile, maniacal demons. And what happened to them? Dumped into the lake with 2,000 pigs, remember? Maybe they thought the evil spirit that was causing the storm was coming after them, approaching them on the lake. Picture this. I mean, they're rowing for all they're worth. They're facing east. You ever rowed a boat? You know, you face the opposite direction that you row. So they're trying to go to the west shore. They're facing east. They're pulling on the oars. And Jesus approaches from the east. There's a full moon. Suddenly you see off in the distance something. You can't make it out. What is that? That's weird. I'll just ignore it. Now someone else in the boat sees it. He doesn't say anything either. Pretty soon, there's no denying what this is. This form, I mean, this outline of a man becomes obvious enough that everyone sees it, and you can't deny that something's there. And you say, well, do you see that? What is that? I don't know. It looks like a person. And it's moving toward the boat. It's walking so fast, it's catching up. I mean, it's coming closer and closer. You find yourself pulling harder and harder on the oars. Now they're all rowing like crazy, and you're zooming. He starts running, he's catching up. I don't know if you had to run, but you imagine they started pulling on those oars. And pretty soon, all 12 guys are screaming in fear. Now, as I said last week, the average man is a little self-conscious about screaming in fear. Especially around a bunch of other guys. You don't just see something you don't understand. Say, oh, it's a ghost! You have to be something has to be very evident before you start doing that. And so there they are, and they are yelling. All these guys are yelling, and they're scared out of their minds, and this thing is catching up, and they don't know what it is. And suddenly, at the height of the panic, they hear this absolutely unmistakable voice, verse 27. Jesus immediately said to them, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. Immediately their fears are dispelled. Oh, and think of that. Isn't that something? Did you realize only Jesus could do that? Only Jesus could dispel this kind of terror by just saying, it is I. Think of that. No one else could do that. I mean, if you're out at sea and you're terrified because you see somebody approaching the boat walking on the water, and then he says, don't be afraid, it's just your Uncle George. Well, that's no, I mean, you're just as afraid now as you ever were. That's just as bizarre as anything else. But Jesus just identifies himself and the crisis is over. Now think through the implications of that. They're not afraid of the storm. They're afraid of Christ. They're not afraid of the wind and the waves. They're afraid of Jesus before they knew who he was. It's really important. Because the very one who was coming there to deliver them was the one that they thought they needed deliverance from. The very thing they were most afraid of turned out to be their salvation. How many times have you seen some terrorizing thing out on the horizon of your life, and it's coming toward you, and it's approaching, and it's going to get here tomorrow, it's going to get here next week, or next month, or in a year, or sometime, and you are gripped with fear. You see this thing approaching, and it's looming, and you don't know how you're going to handle it, and it scares you to death. And then, when it comes, it turns out to be none other than the very blessings of God sent to comfort you. Sometimes We're the most afraid when we're the least in danger. That's what happens to these guys. I mean, they're terrified because Jesus is approaching them. They're like Mary, who was terrified at the sight of the angel who was there to bring her the best news that had ever been delivered to anybody. Or the women at the tomb who wept bitterly because Jesus' body was missing on the third day. Now, there's a crisis, right? The Messiah's body is not in the tomb on the third day. What a disaster. Sometimes the things we're the most upset over are the greatest blessings of God. We just don't realize it. Sometimes the most precious gifts of God are the things that cause us the most fear in our lives. Sometimes you have something in your life that's a difficulty. You cry out to God for help. You long for relief. You beg for relief. And it's a problem you can't solve. And it scares you to death. And you don't know what to do. And sometimes you may have to wait. You may have to wait a long time. You may have to wait all the way to the fourth watch of the night. But sometimes then the Lord ends up finally coming and bringing relief. And the relief ends up being no change in the circumstances. Just knowledge. Just information. Just understanding. He just opens your eyes to see that, no, this is not a curse, this is a blessing. Sends you a blessing that scares you, and you cry out to help to God for deliverance, and He answers the prayer just by opening your eyes to see that it's a blessing and not a curse. And He shows you that the enemy that you're so afraid of is really your friend. I had insomnia for well over a year, and I really felt like that was a curse. I felt like it was ruining my life, ruining my ministry, I couldn't function. It was such a problem, and then one day it occurred to me that maybe the Lord wasn't granting me sleep because He wanted me to spend some time with Him at night. Like David, who thought of God through the watches of the night. So I started doing that. I got up a few times and had a fantastic time with the Lord. It was a very fruitful, profitable time, and I loved it. And then I started sleeping. And ever since, I've been sleeping since that better than I've slept in years since then. And it turned out my enemy was really my friend. It was a blessing. And just before God took that blessing away, He opened my eyes and enabled me to enjoy it for a few nights before taking it away. I want to show you one other thing in verse 50. You see that word immediately? You see Jesus' love and compassion in that word? Immediately. They cry out in fear. He doesn't stand back out of their view laughing at them. Look at these ninnies laughing. You know, He's not making... As soon as they cry out, instantly He responds. Now, sometimes there's a need for God to delay because He's got a purpose for that. And Jesus did allow them to experience the terror before identifying Himself, and there was a purpose for that, because He's testing and building their faith. But the split second that purpose is accomplished, the rescue is instantaneous. God can't withhold Himself for 1 second. After that purpose is done, He immediately rescues. Same thing with Peter. That's pretty neat. You know, we left off the story a minute ago with Peter plunging down into the water. Look at verse 30. Peter saw the wind, he was afraid, and he began to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me." Now, I did a little thinking on this. Peter suddenly sinks. He cries out to Jesus. And what does Jesus do? Does He let Peter sink for a while just to teach him a lesson? Does He stand there and watch the bubbles as Peter's down under there and, then reach down under and pull him back up? Did He let Peter go down? I mean, Peter could swim. It's not going to the end of his life if he goes under for a few seconds. No. There's no indication that happened. Jesus didn't rebuke first and then rescue. He rescued first and then rebuked. Verse 31. Immediately. Again. Jesus reached out His hand and caught him. And then He rebuked him. First He saved, then He rebuked. There's no indication that Peter ever went under the water. Jesus rescued Peter with unbelievable speed. Now I was trying to think this through. If you're standing on water and suddenly you begin to sink. I don't know. I didn't do this with my stopwatch, but I my guess is you have about a half a second before your face goes under. From the time your feet start sinking until your head goes under, you got about a half a second. And I don't know how fast Peter's reaction times were, but he's walking on the water, and so he's standing on it just fine. That's working out. But then he starts to sink. Now, how much of that half second do you suppose was taken up by Peter realizing what's happening, sensing that he's sinking, making the decision to cry out for help, and then articulating the words of the sentence that he cried out, "Kyrie sozon me," "Lord, save me"? I don't know how that strikes you, but I don't think it's possible. There's not enough time. You say, well, maybe Peter was sinking slowly, like quicksand. You know, maybe his faith is just giving out a little bit. So, you know, I'm losing it, I'm sinking. No. The problem with that is that this word sink literally means to plunge down or to drown. It's a dramatic word. He's not sinking slowly. He's plunging just like you. It's not a fairy tale. This is real water. And without Jesus holding up, the same thing, what happened to Peter was exactly what happens to you when you step on water. He went straight down. This is real. Wind is real. Waves are real. Water is wet. This is what happened to Peter is real. And Jesus doesn't use a miracle here to lift him back up. He just grabs him. Jesus must have had lightning fast reactions, and he grabs Peter. And it seems to me, for the timing of all this to work, Peter doesn't have enough time to realize all that's happening and then articulate this sentence. I think Jesus had to grab Peter before Peter got the rest of this sentence all the way out of his mouth, "Lord, save me." It has to be that way, otherwise there's not enough time. Before he could get the words out of his mouth of the prayer, Jesus had already saved him. But that comes as no surprise, right? Because isn't that the way God is? Isn't he eager to save us? Doesn't Isaiah 65:24 say, "Before they call on me, I will answer. And while they're still speaking, I will hear." God is so anxious to respond to you. Isaiah 30:18, Yahweh longs to be gracious to you. He longs. He's on the edge of his seat, looking for an excuse to bless you. It's always what the Lord wants to do when you cry out to him. Which means if he ever delays, in rescuing, even 0.5 seconds, then you better believe that you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there must be some very, very important reason why he's delaying. Now, sometimes a trial has to be extended so that the weakness in your faith can be discovered and strengthened, like Peter. The number of possibilities, people say, why is this trial continuing on and on and on? Well, the number of reasons of that is as many as God's plan is vast. But if you ever find yourself imagining that maybe God is making you wait for no good reason, just ask yourself, do you do that with your kids? When they're in trouble? How compelling and important a reason does it take for you to be willing to let your children suffer terribly without rescuing them when you have the ability to rescue them? How important a reason does that take? God loves you far more than you will ever love your children. There's no reason for fear. I love what Jesus asked Peter. He asked him, "Why did you doubt?" I don't know if Peter answered, but if he did, think of how dumb it would have sounded. "I remember the loaves and fishes. I can see that you can create ex nihilo out of nothing. You can do things only God can do. I can see that you're walking on water. I can see that you enabled me to walk on water. You still the storm. You dispel demons. You do all that power. But I doubted because of the wind." Sounds ridiculous. But all our doubting is ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, what doubt do we have when we doubt God? What doubt isn't ridiculous? Worry for the Christian is always ridiculous. Jesus asked Peter to tell him, "Why did you doubt?" And sometimes I think that's the best thing you can do is just answer that question. Just verbalize it. "I'm worrying, and here's why." Next time you're worried, just ask yourself, verbalize it. Are you afraid that some suffering is going to come into your life that will cause ultimate harm rather than ultimate good despite all of God's promises to the contrary? Are you afraid that God is going to suddenly stop providing for you, even though he's promised to provide for you? What are you worried about? Very often, just by asking that question and then giving an answer, you can see the foolishness of it. You can see how ridiculous the worry is just by that. All right, so the disciples, they're scared out of their shorts. They panic. Jesus says, it's "I, fear not." And those words are critical. Every one of the accounts of this miracle, there's 3 different accounts. They all vary quite a bit, quite a bit. Matthew mentions Peter walking on the water. Mark and John don't bother mentioning that. Mark focuses on the hard-heartedness. John and Matthew don't mention that. John talks about the boat being miraculously transported to shore. Matthew and Mark don't focus on that. So they're very different. Each account is very different because they have different purposes.
But there's one thing that's identical in all 3 accounts, letter for letter in the Greek, and it's Jesus' words, "It is I, don't be afraid." When 3 people write about a complex event decades later, you can expect differences, not necessarily contradictions, but some significant differences in the way they report it. But once in a while, there's something that is so dramatic that as many as 50 to 60 years later, 3 different people report that sentence with identical words. I had a friend in Oklahoma who was a World War II vet, and he used to tell stories about the war that were just riveting. And after having heard some of his stories, I noticed that when he told someone else the same story, the dialogue was exactly the same, word for word. He said he could remember it like it was yesterday. Now, this was an old guy, and he had a tough time remembering things that had happened the day before, but he could remember things that happened way back in World War II, word for word. It takes quite a dramatic event for something to stick in your mind exactly for decades like that. And I'm sure they remembered, the disciples remembered a lot of things in generalities, and very often the gospel writers paraphrase what people said. But in this case, these men, as long as they lived, never forgot the exact sounds that came out of Jesus' mouth. Take courage. I am, literally, ego eimi, do not be afraid. This is one of those moments that was so profound, it burned an impression on the souls of these men that would never fade. Matthew framed these words with the rest of the story. They appear exactly in the middle of Matthew's account. The split second the testing is over, Jesus responds and restores them and fortifies their faith. He calms them with His voice, rescues Peter with His hand, stills the storm with His presence, and brings them to shore with His power. The trial has served its purpose. The test is all over. The weaknesses in their hearts have been exposed, and their faith is strengthened and fortified, and all Jesus wants to do now is put an immediate end to that trial. I hope you understand about the loaves. I hope your attention isn't distracted by the waves. I hope you always seek to turn your eyes upon Jesus, to look full in His wonderful face. And the things of this earth will grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace.